Hello and welcome to the OME Talks podcast. I'm your host, David Petro. On the OME Talks podcast, we feature speakers from our previous live conference where they give us previews of their upcoming webinars. We are deep into season 8, and this month we are talking with Vanessa Vicaria, where she is previewing her webinar, Math Therapy, How to Help Students Overcome Their Fear of Math. This podcast is a preview of her December 10th webinar, so let's get right to it. Okay, so I'm talking to Vanessa Vicaria. Vanessa, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for asking. So Vanessa, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you are connected to math.
Ooh, yes. I mean, that is a hot question right off the top there. I think I'm going to say, how am I connected to math? The first thing that honestly comes to mind is that I'm a human being walking on planet Earth. A planet and existence that is largely comprised of math. So in that way, I am deeply and spiritually connected to math just by living, you know? But how is my work maybe connected to math? Like I can take, you know, like a little more. I'm personally connected to math and like the math education community in a different way than just my existence. And that is that I'm a math therapist. So I have been a teacher and tutor for over 25 years, and I have always really valued the embodied experience of students and teachers when teaching and learning mathematics. So my work is very centered in math trauma, math anxiety, and the emotions that we bring to learning and teaching math.
So now I'm curious, if you're saying you're a math therapist, are there other math therapists out there?
There are. Well, you know what? I don't want to be like I started the trend because I certainly did not. I will say, I'm going to be so bold as to say, I think that most, if you're teaching math in any capacity, part of the work you're doing is you are maybe unconsciously, inadvertently dealing with therapeutic elements of teaching. I mean, if we think about our practice, we're not just, you know, shoving content at robots. We are teaching human beings, and all of the teachers I know really consider the humans in front of them when they're teaching math. Like, you know, when we talk about student-centered approaches, when we talk about how to help kids engage and to mitigate math anxiety, even when we're talking about different teaching strategies and instructional practices and pedagogy, we're always thinking about how do we get the person in front of us to be open and curious and willing to understand new content. And that is a therapeutic practice. So even though we might not officially call ourselves math therapists, I find that ever since I started officially calling myself a math therapist and, you know, published a book called Math Therapy, so many teachers say to me, oh my God, what I've been doing this whole time is math therapy. I just didn't have a label for it. And I know probably over 100 teachers now that now include math therapist or math therapy in their email signature line and, you know, will boldly claim, yes, I am a math therapist. And I think, you know, labels can be limiting and they can be liberating. So it's not so much about the term, but I think it's very important for us to recognize that our practice is the practice of centering humans. And that means we're dealing with very complicated emotions and there are therapeutic elements to our teaching.
So perhaps what we really need is just a rebrand from math teacher to math therapist.
I mean, like, I think the problem is terms are so loaded, right? And it's like, just like anything, the term therapist gets a bad rap and we have stereotypes and connotations that go along with that. I think this is actually a really interesting conversation and what you're bringing up, because you will have people that are like, oh my God, like, yes, like that really resonates with me and kids and parents are really drawn to that. And then you'll have the opposite where people are like, whoa, like you're going to therapize me? Like, what are you going to do? Like, give me a lobotomy? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like every field and every label has a lot associated with it. So I think it's more like the recognition that as teachers, we are healers. And even though we might not call ourselves that, and that's not exactly what we learned in teachers college, we, I think, are moving more and more towards at least very like openly recognizing that emotions have space in math class. And if we ignore them, we're leaving out many students. I mean, I know this is your podcast, but would you consider yourself a math therapist?
I'm leaning that way a lot more. Oh. After hearing a lot of what you're saying, that it makes a lot of sense to me that that is part of what we have to do in a math class, given the nature of the beast, as it were.
Well, and like you've been teaching math for a very long time, right?
Yeah, over 3 decades for sure.
Okay, so have you so this is a good question. Have you always considered like the emotional component of math teaching, or is this something that's new for you? Or are you like, oh, I've always been doing that. Like maybe I can lean more into that label. Like what's the vibe?
Oh, well, the vibe is no. I was definitely far in the other camp of the robot for many years, And, you know, I've had my own set of epiphanies, but it's fine. I would think that a lot of what you have said has sort of defined a lot of those ideas that I was starting to already, you know, incorporate into my classes.
Oh my God, this is so, well, I think this is actually really important for everyone to know. It's like you know, whoever's listening to this, who knows how long you've been teaching for, obviously things have changed and our mindsets have changed, but I think it's really cool to be able to say, so thank you, to be like, yeah, you know what, I didn't always think about this and now I'm starting to consider it, which is basically exactly what we want our students to do in math class is, yeah, maybe you never thought you'd be good at math or that you might like math, but could you be a little open to something new? So I actually think us being open as teachers models what it's like to be open about new knowledge as students.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I always ask our guests how they first heard of or got involved with OME. Now, I know the first time I came across you was when I was chairing the OME 2022 conference and you were one of our featured speakers. But I'm curious about your own experience of how you got involved with or heard of OME.
Well, this is so interesting you bring this up because me and the math teacher who changed my life in high school, we were just chatting the other day because we were like, oh my God, 25 years later, we should do a session together at OME. We were talking about this because we were reminiscing about when we both separately presented at OME, like I think a decade ago. I think I had presented there before. Like I think my first OME talk was probably, I'm going to say like 2015, 2014-ish, maybe even earlier. I actually at that point had just finished my master's thesis, which was called Imagining a World Where Paris Hilton Loves Math. And I was talking about media representations of gender and mathematics and how that affects our students. So I think my first ever OME talk was about that. I think the talk itself was called Imagining a World Where Paris Hilton Loves Math. And then the next year, me and my old math teacher from high school, we did a presentation together. I don't remember what it was about, but we did. And then I never came back until you met me in 2022. So that was my history. I don't know how I heard about it or anything like that. I just remember it was a while ago that it first came into the fold.
I always find it interesting where there are some teachers that the first time their involvement is as a presenter, as opposed to as a participant. So, and that was my own experience years ago. My first involvement was as a presenter, and I actually just sort of fell in love with that community.
It's a beautiful community. It's actually so funny now that you're judging this up for me because I'm now remembering that last year at OME, so the most recent one. My other from the same school that changed my life, another high school math teacher of mine was there in the audience and I had not seen him in literally 25 years. So now I'm really like, oh my gosh, we really need to all do something together because there's like a weird little circular situation going on here. Okay, anyway.
All right. So let's get to what we're about to talk about. So this month you are going to be doing a repeat of your OME session this year, your live session as a virtual one as Math Therapy, How to Help Students Overcome Their Fear of Math. I wonder if you could give our listeners a little bit of a brief Reader's Digest description of what that talk is going to be about.
Yes. Okay. So my work is in math trauma and math therapy, as we've discussed. This talk I really love because it's sort of a bit of a deep dive into the differences between math trauma and math anxiety. A little bit of an understanding of that because there is a really big difference and math trauma is something we've only started talking about. And as you'll discover in my talk, it really is the foundation for what we see as math anxiety. And right now, I feel like a lot of our interventions are based on sort of de-escalating students or teachers, right? You might be a teacher listening to this with your own math anxiety. We're trying to de-escalate in the moment. And this talk is about how to get kind of to the root and to stop the spiral that happens when we are experiencing math anxiety from a math trauma. Because basically we go into anxiety, like there's a fear trigger, like a test is announced, or as a teacher, we have to teach a new concept that we're not familiar with or we don't feel good about. We go into anxiety and then we go into avoidance. And when we go into avoidance as students or as teachers, we either never take that next step into trying a new instructional practice, or as a student, we never take that next step into engaging with math content in a way that will produce learning, and things just shut down. So this talk is all about how to understand what's going on, and then I'm going to share three interventions to get students to engage with math, because every time we engage with math, we will eventually get better at it, right? We can't get better unless we engage. So I'm going to be sharing three strategies on how to get students to engage with math even when they're at risk of spiraling into that math anxiety avoidance cycle.
So now you got me thinking, it sounds like there's maybe four situations now. A situation where the teacher has no anxiety and the student has no anxiety on a particular topic. This situation where the teacher has no anxiety, but the student does. A situation where the teacher has the anxiety about the teaching subject, but the student doesn't. And then the culmination of that, where both the teacher and the student have anxiety about the topic. Am I missing
the situation? I love that you just, you know what? I've never even thought about it this way, but I love that you just mathematized that so quickly. I'm like, oh my God, this is actually a great talk idea to do all four cases. No, I think you've got it there. I think what's interesting is, like, the only thing I would like kind of tweak is, like, it doesn't even have to be anxiety about the topic. I think it's kind of like any sort of lingering math trauma that might lead either student or teacher to be in a state where they're very vulnerable to, like, shut down and avoid, because they don't want to feel any discomfort, you know? But, like, yeah, I think you've got it. I think you've got the four situations.
You know, and I think a lot of times people in general don't like to feel discomfort. Yeah. And I think that is the root of a lot of sort of some of these issues, whether it be math class or life in general.
It literally, I mean, I couldn't have said it better. That's it. We want to avoid discomfort, and we associate certain feelings with discomfort. And one of the biggest things that produces discomfort is change, right? Trying something new, because you're probably not going to get the outcome you want the first time. And that is seen as failure, and failure is seen as discomfort. So it's like, if you think about just that alone in your own life, like if you're listening to this and you have nothing to do with math in your life, just think about that statement and think about how true that is for all of us, right? Even as adults. And the problem is, though, the easiest way to avoid discomfort is to simply not try a new thing. You know, but then that produces a discomfort of its very own, because you're in stagnation or you're doing something that's out of alignment. It's like we're kind of like towing this line. And as educators, we know that learning, what is learning but novelty, right? You are learning something new. You are doing things that produce change or that challenge your paradigm. It's going to be uncomfortable, but we know that that is what ultimately leads to growth. So how do we not only encourage that in our students, but how do we embody that as teachers who are often challenged to rethink how we're currently teaching things?
So I wonder, in your travels, in giving talks and speaking to teachers, I'm sure you've sort of had a spectrum of responses to your talk. You know, when I think about it, I wonder if there is a divide between teachers who are teaching math in secondary school versus teachers who are teaching math in elementary school. I kind of get a sense, and I have zero data on this, but, you know, when you're teaching math in secondary school, that's a choice most of the time. And when you're teaching math in elementary school, in many times, you know, you're just teaching math because it's just one of the other subjects that you have to teach. And if you're noticing differences there in the different panels.
100%. You know, not only is it a choice in secondary school, you know, if you're teaching math, but if you're teaching math in secondary school and it is your choice, which, you know, in most cases it is, you've also taken math post-secondary, right? You will have had, depending on what state or province you're in, you will have had to have done some math. In the US, a lot of states actually require you to have a math degree, a full math degree, to teach math in secondary. I know we don't do that in Ontario, but you do have to take some university math courses. So there is already, I honestly think one of the big, well, and I've seen one of the biggest differences is the level of anxiety the teacher has around math, because this is very well documented that so many elementary teachers are deeply anxious about math, right? Like exactly like you said, they're not voluntarily teaching math. And you know what? Take teachers out of the equation for a second. I did not mean to make that math pun, but there it is. But take them out for a second. If we look at the general population of adults, right? Research is now showing us that 70 to 90% of adults experience deep math anxiety, right? So look at that population as a whole, and now distill it down to like the teaching population. So you're an elementary school teacher. You're not choosing to teach math, but you want to teach. That same statistic is going to pretty much hold, right? Whereas like we're going to drag it down to be like, well, 70-ish percent of elementary school teachers have math anxiety. Now, I know we can't like drag it down exactly because, you know, which of those math anxious adults are now choosing to become teachers, la, 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 la. I'm doing a very bad job of explaining this. My point to say that most adults have anxiety around math, and that does not change when we talk about our teaching population that are elementary math teachers who did not make the choice to teach math and did not necessarily and probably almost never took a post-secondary math course. So I think the biggest things I'll see that are different, and by the way, I talk to high school teachers all the time who have experienced math trauma and have anxiety around math, but it is way more prevalent in the elementary teacher population. Now, it's not always, like there are lots of elementary teachers who love math, but and don't feel anxious around it, but it's pretty prevalent. So we have to sort of keep that in mind. And it's like, it's really, you know, it's a problem because we need to support these teachers. They are teaching our children foundational math skills, you know, and I always say we're not all teachers of math, but we're all teachers of math attitudes. So, and that applies not just to teachers, but to everyone. So I think it's like really interesting to watch. And what I think is the most beautiful thing is there are so many, I mean, I've spoken to thousands and thousands of elementary teachers just in the past month who are so passionate, who, yes, they have anxiety around math, but the reason they are so excited to teach math at the elementary level, despite their anxiety, is they want to make sure the kids in front of them don't develop the same anxiety they had. Like they are determined, they're doing the work. It's like, this is, I think, what's going to be one of the biggest game changers of teaching at this time.
So now you're suggesting, you said that you have three suggestions for students in your talk to help reduce math anxiety. A, I wonder if you could give us a hint as to maybe what one of those might be. And B, since we're on the topic of teachers, are there suggestions for teachers as well?
Yeah, you know what? So, okay, I can give you a little hint, but I don't want to like ruin the whole thing. So I want you to come to my talk. But yes, I will say, you know, even my book, Math Therapy, is directed at teachers to help their students. But every single thing in that book can be done by a teacher. They're all things you can flip and do yourself. It's all the same thing. It's just how you carry out the activity. And the exact same is true for this talk. You know, one of the things I talk about, one of my strategies is about actually task scaling. So all of my strategies are rooted in cognitive behavioral therapy because I deeply believe that growth mindset needs to be more than a belief. Again, research shows us so much of Joe Bowler's work is centered around the fact that growth mindset alone as a philosophy is not going to move the dial, right? It's actually very victim blamey to be like, your brain can change, like, you know, just learn new things. Like, and if you're not believing it enough, then that's why you're failing. We have to give kids and teachers new behaviors. So for growth mindset to be actualized, for your brain to grow and change, you have to engage in a behavior that is different than the one you have been engaging in that has produced the results you have now. So that's why I use cognitive behavioral strategy, because it's all about how to tie that belief piece with the behavior piece. Now, again, this talk is about how to stop the fear, anticipatory anxiety, avoidance cycle. And you stop it by stopping the avoidance, right? Every time we avoid something, we reaffirm the fact that the thing is meant to be avoided. So every time I did this morning, I'm not going to lie. Like I was like, Vanessa, you should go to the gym and you should work out. And I didn't do it. I avoided it. And you feel that short-term relief. It was so nice. But now I'm like, oh my God, now I'm feeling guilty. I'm feeling like it's even more impossible. Tomorrow I'm going to go through the same cycle. But I know if I just go to the gym, all of a sudden I see that was not so bad. I actually feel kind of good afterwards. Right? But like you have to do the thing. And the same is true with math. We want kids to engage with math so they can see it's not so bad. Maybe they actually get something out of it. Maybe they do something that surprises them. So one of the things I'm going to share is task scaling. And task scaling is how do we break a task down? Like, you know, maybe it's like, you know, we want someone to add like a half plus two thirds. That's the ultimate goal. How do we get the kid who's looking at that being like, I'm not even going to try this. This is impossible. I don't even know where to start. I'm going to avoid. Shut down. Done. How can we get a kid engaged in that question? How can we break it down? How can we start with a lower floor? What are some things we can do to any question we have in front of us so we don't need a whole new curriculum or a whole new textbook? I'm going to share some strategies of things we can do for any question in front of us to get every single kid involved. That's the only hint I'm giving you. I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to do it. But like the point is like, what is a new behavior here? We have the question. We want kids to do the question. They shut down. What is a new behavior we can give them that will get them to engage with that question and ultimately get to the point where they're trying the question in front of them?
I'm a big fan of cognitive behavior therapy. One of my core values is basically that we should all not only not avoid doing hard things, we should seek out doing hard things. And I think that one of the, for lack of a better word, tricks of a teacher in helping students is to sort of follow the adage of no pain, no gain. That is so prevalent in, you know, the workout space, of the physical workout space. It's the same for your brain. I mean, mm-hmm. In order for your brain to develop, you have to give it some stress. The hard part about teaching is finding this right stress for each student. And that is not the same mm-hmm. for every student. In the same way, you know, someone who is new to working out, you wouldn't give them 150 pounds to start to bench press. You got to find the right hard thing for them to do that is attainable, but not unattainable. Difficult, but not so difficult that it discourages them, right?
100%. Well, and that's productive struggle, right? Like that's what we're trying to do with that. And you've got a class of like 30 plus kids in front of you. So how do you do that? But there is a way to do it. Like there are, I'm sure a ton of you listening are like, yeah, I try that. I do this. I do that, the other. And I think exactly what you said. I love that. It's no pain, no gain. But too, I'm going to add on to that, you know, you're an adult saying this. I know you're a runner, right? Aren't you?
I like to say that. Triathlete. Yeah. We'll say that.
Yeah. Triathlete. Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. Whoa. Yeah. You're a triathlete, right? I'm telling you, I can't even get to the gym in the morning, but you're a triathlete and you know, you're an adult now that like kind of understands that. How do we get kids to see that when they are so rooted often in the anxiety they're feeling around what we talked about earlier? They're so scared of that discomfort. So I think there's two parts there is like, we've got to normalize discomfort. We have to find a way to be like, it's not the enemy if you feel this emotion. But I mean, there's a lot we could go on and on about this. Like part of that has to do with framing what the goal is of a math class. Because if the goal of a math class is to get a right answer, all of a sudden we can't really be like, but don't worry, it's not uncomfortable if you don't get it. We kind of have to change the goal of math class for our students. And then we can be like, yeah, engage. It's not so scary because the outcome isn't even the goal. Like, do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot going on here. So I think there's a lot. We could do a whole podcast series on this, right? It's like all of these elements sort of have to happen together. Like, you know that if you go to bench press something and you can't bench press it, you're like, that's cool. I get it. Because you know what? Like, I know that I'm going to, you know, go one, pardon my terminology, but you're going to go 5 pounds lower or whatever it is. And you're still going to be working out a muscle. And ultimately you'll get to that next weight. You're not in trouble if you can't bench press 150 pounds. Nothing bad is going to happen to you. You're not going to not get into university. Like, you're just going to try again next week. No one's going to be like, you're not at grade level. Go into the lower group. Like, you're not, right? So I think we as educators have to put our money where our mouth is a bit. And if we want that attitude in math class, we have to shift the culture of our math classes.
Oh, that should be easy, right?
Yeah, no big deal. It's totally fine. We're not working in an oppressive system. Like, it's totally cool.
So one last question to wrap up. I'm curious, you know, over the years of you talking about math therapy, have there been any things that you have shifted in what you're saying from sort of your beginning of your journey to now?
What a great question. Absolutely. honestly, so, you know what my biggest thing right now, I have to tell you? So I have this podcast, Math Therapy, and I don't know, I actually am curious how I actually remember how I talk about this in the book. So one of the questions I ask on my podcast, you know, the question I ask every guest at the end of the podcast is, what would you say if someone comes up to you and says, well, I'm not a math person? You know, and I now have like almost 100 responses to this question, and it's gotten me reflecting on my response and what I think I wrote in the book, which is, you know, we're all math people, this kind of thing. And, you know, there's no such thing as not being a math person. And I've really shifted my take on that. I'm really now at the point, I was just talking to someone about this last week, where I'm like, I think, you know, I would not say any of those things anymore. You know, I used to be a teller. I'd be like, you know, like someone says they're not a math person, you show them all the ways they are a math person. And now I've really, I think one of the biggest shifts I've made over the course of like the past year is it's almost always better to ask instead of telling. You know, when a student says, I'm not a math person, when a parent says, you know, I don't have the math gene, so my kid probably doesn't have one. When a teacher says, oh no, I'm not good at math. It's always better to pause and say, can I ask you why you think that? It's almost always better to do that than to say, nope, let me tell you all the ways that you're wrong. And that has shifted my practice so much. And all the teachers that I've coached and I've been talking to for the past year, it has been one of the biggest shifts I've made and one of the biggest ones that they've reported back to say, wow, you'll never believe what happened when I asked that question instead of telling that person they were a math person. So I think I'm really, that's a big, big shift. And okay, I'm going to say this here for the first time publicly. I think I might be in the camp now of nobody's a math person because it just doesn't exist, instead of a we're all math people. Because I'm really starting to be like, there are so many connotations tied with the term math person that students don't want to be math people, because it's not even about just knowing math. It's like, if you're a math person, you're like a loser that needs a makeover. You know, you don't have any friends. Like, there's so much going on. I think I never realized how loaded that term was, and how when someone says they're not a math person, they're not just saying they have no math ability. They're almost sometimes resisting the label because they don't want it. And I think maybe I've been going about this the wrong way. So there you go.
All right. And actually, I would, you know, that totally resonates with me, because that question of why do you think is, that's my go-to question all the time. You know, and when a student asks me, is this right? My response is, why do you think it's right?
Right. Right. Exactly. Yes, totally. Yeah, that's funny. I didn't even like, exactly. We're talking about thinking so much in actual math teaching. And I think I'm now sort of like, I've always been a question asker anyways, but I think, you know, I think we're so impassioned. We want to jump in and like save, actually, wow, you're making me realize this is exactly the same thing. Cause like, you want to save the student, right? You want to be like, no, let me help you. And when someone says, I'm not a math person, you want to be like, no, let me make you feel better. But it's like, it's always better to pause, keep it together for a second and ask why, and let them unpack that. Because also too, when they do that, you know, you as a math teacher can then be like, oh, I see where you're coming from. Now I've got more to work with. And when you say that, when someone says I'm not a math person, you start understanding why they think they're not a math person. Everybody doesn't say I'm not a math person for the same reason. Everyone has a different reason they don't feel they don't belong to the world of math. So the more personalized you can make your response, the more effective it's going to be. And it's not going to be personalized unless you ask the question.
Okay. Well, I think that we have given a little bit of a preview of your upcoming OME talk for members. And yeah. We're going to wrap that up for today and look forward to hearing you speak to us in a few weeks. So Vanessa, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you for asking such good questions and like low-key letting me interview you for 2 minutes.
All right. And we'll see you when we have our talk.
Sounds good.
That was Vanessa Vicaria previewing her December 10th webinar, Math Therapy, How to Help Students Overcome Their Fear of Math. That webinar is for OME members only, and they can register on our MCIS registration site. A link to that and our OME Talks website can be found in the podcast description. Next month, we'll be wrapping up our regular episodes for Season 8 by talking with Sonia Sherral, Rosanna Mortellaro, and Nicole Peckham, where they will be talking about braiding Indigenous ways of knowing with Western knowledge of math in the classroom. So stay tuned for that, and in the meantime, stay safe.